history.
Slavery chained and broke at last.
Slavery chained
and Fanny Kemble was a renowned British stage actress, but she was destined for quite different fame when she married a Georgia plantation and slave owner and then decided to fight the slave system. Our guest this week, Catherine Clinton, tells us Kemble's remarkable story. Clinton is the author of Fanny Kemble's Civil War, the story of America's most unlikely abolitionist. Her remarks were recorded at station WNYE-FM in New York City for The Teacher as Historian and Talking History.
Henry James liked to say that his great friend Fanny Kemble was meant to be twins, for she manifested energy, talent, and personal conflict enough for two individual women joined in spirit by an all-consuming passion for living. Her life bridged a historic expanse from the first decade of the 19th century to its last. As a girl, Fanny basked in the reflected glory of the Kemble family, who were theatrical royalty in England. Following the lead of her legendary aunt, Sarah Siddons, Fanny Kemble launched her celebrity on stage, but the acclaim, and not infrequently notoriety, that engulfed her for well over a half a century rested as much on her literary talents and personal magnetism as on her acting career. She turned to writing after marrying a wealthy American who insisted she retire from the stage. The marriage changed more than her name. The vibrant ingenue became a morose and restless matron. The eventual divorce and her bitter estrangement from her children devastatingly marred her private life. But these clashes pale considerably against her most courageous struggle, the fight she waged against slavery. In 1836, when she had been married for just 2 years, Kemble's husband, Pierce Butler, inherited the second largest slave-owning empire in Georgia. Her eyewitness testimony of life on an antebellum plantation offered a disquieting glimpse into the world the slaveholders made. Published in 1863 as Journal of a Residence on a Georgian Plantation, Kemble's vivid writings, replete with insights on women's rights, slavery, and race, made an indelible impact. Newsmongers claimed that the work influenced England to deny the Confederacy's plea for diplomatic recognition. Abolitionists in England and America celebrated the journal for portraying with grace and humanity the plight of enslaved blacks. This international bestseller permanently linked Kemble's name with debates over slavery and made good on her solemn pledge that it was her, quote, imperative duty, knowing what I know and having seen what I have seen, to do all that lies in my power to show the dangers and the evils of this frightful institution. Kemble's passion and vitality leaped from nearly every page she wrote. When John Brown was hanged in 1859, Kemble prophesied, "From his grave a root of bitterness will spring, the fruit of which at no distant day may be disunion and civil war." These words would ring as true for her adopted nation as for herself. Americans fought to the death over sectional, racial, and political ideals, conflicts tragically replicated within Kemble's own family. As a British abolitionist, married to a Southern plantation owner, she was an unlikely heroine of the Union cause. She bore two daughters, one loyal to the Union, the other to the Confederacy. Her marriage foundered, much as the Union had. For the rest of her life, Kemble struggled to erase the effects of family mistrust and betrayal, to heal the wounds left by bonds rent asunder. Her quest bleakly mirrored the fraught political and social interactions that characterize the years of Reconstruction and beyond. Henry James once predicted that Fanny Kemble's literary gifts would make her what I call historic. Kemble published nearly a dozen volumes of memoir, creating a permanent record of her strong-mindedness and unerring resolve. She was less willing to reveal the intricacies that lay beneath her beguiling demeanor. An obscure letter tucked away in a collection illuminates one such tantalizing complexity. For years after her divorce from Pierce Butler, even after his death, Fanny Kemble preserved in her sewing basket a scrap of her wedding dress, a nostalgic reminder of the fragile love story she and her husband shared. Fanny Kemble's Civil Wars is a tribute to the remarkable psyche that fueled her restless energy, to the tangle of contradictions that compel us to revisit her remarkable career. Chapter 5, The War Over Slavery. At the time of his death in 1822, Major Pierce Butler, the second largest slaveholder in Georgia, passed that mantle to his heirs, Pierce and John Butler. Just as their grandfather practiced seasonal migration, spending the winter months in Georgia, watching over his kingdom, now so did the Butler brothers of Philadelphia. Upon taking possession in 1836, they traveled to Georgia to inspect their inheritance, a magnificent conglomeration of estates along the Altamaha River near the port of Darien. Major Pierce Butler had given up his post in the British Army to marry a Low Country heiress, Mary Middleton of South Carolina. Eager to strike out on his own, Pierce Butler commandeered several hundred of his wife's slaves to cultivate rice and cotton on the Georgia Sea Islands. Butler cotton commanded such a high price on the British exchange that it became the standard to which others aspired. After his wife's death in 1790, Major Butler made a permanent home in Philadelphia and became a director of the Bank of the United States. In 1804, when Aaron Burr killed Alexander Hamilton in a duel in Weehawken, New Jersey, Burr traveled south and took refuge at Butler's estate on St. Simons, where his exploits were much admired by local planters. But Burr's visit was eclipsed by the hurricane that year, which swept away 600 barrels of Butler rice and drowned 19 slaves, 16 at Butler's Island. A storm of a different sort broke out in January 1815 when over 130 Butler slaves liberated themselves during a British occupation of Cumberland Island. After the War of 1812, many of these emancipated African Americans, some still calling themselves Butler, were resettled by the British in Bermuda and Nova Scotia. Stories of mirth and bounty made the South loom large in Kemble's imagination. Well aware of the property's state of decline, Pierce Butler warned his wife that accommodations on the island would be primitive, yet she was not deterred. In a vividly detailed travelogue she kept for the benefit of Elizabeth Sedgwick, the South emerged with its stunning beauties and cruelties as a character in its own right.
You're listening to Talking History and Catherine Clinton, the author of Fanny Kemble's Civil War.
By boat, train, and coach, the journey from Philadelphia to the Sea Islands proved arduous. At Portsmouth, Virginia, the tone of Kemble's chronicle altered as she recorded her first encounter with slaves. The sight of them in no way tended to alter my previous opinions of them. They were poorly clothed, looked horribly dirty, and had a lazy recklessness in the air and manner that they sauntered along, which naturally belongs to creatures without one of the responsibilities which are the honorable burden of the rational humanity. Abolitionist leanings notwithstanding, her ignorance showed as she stretched to prove philosophical fundamentals through her observations. The realities of plantation life led her to choose her words more carefully. Kemble landed on Butler's Island, Georgia, on December 30, 1838. Surrounded by natural beauty, she was inspired to explore the island on horseback, marveling at the thick and close embroidery of creeping moss, the most vivid green and red. The place, she concluded, was like a fairy tale. Yet the fairy tale had its monstrous underside. Kemble confessed, "I should like the wild, savage loneliness of the faraway existence extremely, if it were not for the one small item of slavery." Kemble had arrived believing that people on the plantation are well off and consider themselves well off in comparison with the slaves on neighboring estates. But after living among them for months, she found herself praying for a watery apocalypse, to wash my soul and the souls of those I love clean from the blood of our kind. This transformation was not immediate. Fanny's description of her early days on the plantation rely heavily on racial stereotypes. Curious about their new mistress, the slaves, up to 14 at a time, came to her cabin to watch her to write. Unsure of the motive of her visitors, Kemble fashioned the episode into a story whose language reveals prejudice tinged with honesty. "Sometimes at the end of my day's journal, I look up and say suddenly, 'Well, what do you want?' When each black figure springs up at once, as if moved by machinery, they all answer, 'Me come to say, how do you do, missus?' and then they troop out as noiselessly as they entered, like a procession of sable dreams, and I go off in search, if possible, of whiter ones. Fanny found herself increasingly drawn into the plight of the slaves. She seemed distressed by conditions. Whether I be asleep or awake, reading, eating, or walking, in the kitchen, my bedroom, or the parlor, they flock in with urgent entreaties and pitiful stories. Children became her constant concern. Kemble fretted. How horridly brutish it did seem that there's not a girl of 16 on the plantations but has children. Her own husband was quick to demonstrate how little he cared for women's suffering. One winter evening, Kemble reported, Mr. Butler was called out to listen to a complaint of overwork from a gang of pregnant women. I did not stay to listen to the details of their petition, for I am unable to command myself on such occasions, as Mr. Butler seems positively degraded in my eyes as he stood enforcing upon these women the necessity of their fulfilling their appointed tasks. With her husband's craving for mastery aroused, Kemble feared slavery was sure to have similar ill effects on her young daughters. Kemble established a slave hospital and a slave nursery and instructed the overseer to heed the complaints of the ill and the infirm. She paid wages to those slaves who were her personal servants. With the children, she made a game of hygiene, rewarding cleanliness with trinkets. But her relentless interference brought public humiliation. The local doctor defended Butler's longtime standing as a model master. I can state truly that Butler was humane. Indeed, he was indulgent almost to a fault. He scoffed at Kemble's utter ignorance of the Negro character. The overseer advised Butler to bar his wife from hearing petitions. She scorned the overseer's advice. Perhaps he's afraid of the mere contagion of freedom. The way of speaking to the people, of treating them, of living with them, the infinite compassion and human consideration I feel for them. In truth, Kemble cared little for any aspect of planter society, and she especially disliked its female contingent. I pity them for the stupid sameness of their vapid existence. I would rather die, rather 1,000 times, than live the lives of these Georgia planters' wives and daughters. Kemble now knew to a certainty what one South Carolinian had confided. Abolition is impossible because every healthy Negro can fetch $1,000 in the Charleston market at this moment. That the outcry against slavery had been, quote, raised with threefold force within the last few years was little comfort when she was living with a man who perpetuated it. Privately, she hoped that this sojourn among Mr. Butler's slaves may not lessen my respect for him, but I fear it. Fanny Kemble claimed not to embellish or comment in her journal for Elizabeth Sedgwick. I do not wish to add to, or perhaps I ought to say take away from, the effect of such narration by amplifying the simple horror and misery of their bare details. But while she may not have deliberately crafted bare details into abolitionist propaganda, these writings do have a sensational effect. Even as she tried to counter racist rhetoric with provocative reversals, quote, would blacks smell any worse if they were free instead of slave? Kemble dared to make herself vulnerable to scandal. In the face of oppressive daily battles with her husband, Kemble snapped under pressure. Repeating a pattern from her past, she fled the scene of distress. We will never know what drove her. She made a lone dash for a rowboat, determined to escape, and rowed in the dead of night, landing in darkness at Darien. She must have paused, worn down by the exertion of her escape and the intensity of her emotions, just long enough to realize in the warmth of the rising sun that she had no real means to make her way to Philadelphia. The next day, she returned to her two young children. But this time, the rift between her and her husband never seemed to heal. Its cause, a descendant has suggested, was Kemble's discovery of Pierce Butler's illicit sexual liaison with a slave woman. No longer able to carry the burden of her own private war against slavery on the plantation and in her marriage, Kemble succumbed to depression, confessing, I think I should die if I had to live here. During this bleak time, her only solace was to record the stories of the slave women who visited her, so that others might one day know of their suffering and of her own. Fanny has had six children. all dead but one. She came to beg to have her work in the field lightened. Nanny has had 3 children. 2 of them are dead. She came to implore that the rule of sending them into the field 3 weeks after their confinement might be altered. Leah, Caesar's wife, has had 6 children. 3 are dead. Sophie, Lewis's wife, came to beg for some old linen. She is suffering fearfully, has had 10 children, 5 of them are dead. The principal favor she asked was a piece of meat which I gave her. Sally, Scipio's wife, has had 2 miscarriages and 3 children born, one of whom is dead. She came complaining of incessant pain and weakness in her back. This woman was a mulatto daughter of a slave called Sophie by a white man of the name of Walker, who had visited the plantation. Sarah, Stephen's wife, has had 4 miscarriages, had brought 7 children into the world, 5 of whom were dead, and was with child again. She complained of dreadful pains in the back and an internal tumor which swells with the exertion of working in the fields. I think she is ruptured. She told me she had once been mad and had run into the woods, where she contrived to elude discovery for some time, but was at last tracked and brought back when she was tied up by the arms and heavy logs fastened to her feet and was severely flogged. Suki, Bush's wife, only came to pay her respects. She had had 4 miscarriages, had brought 11 children into the world, 5 of whom are dead. Molly also came to see me. Hers was the best account I have yet received. She had 9 children, and 6 of them were still alive. This is only the entry for today in my diary of the people's complaints and visits. Can you conceive a more wretched picture than that which it exhibits of the conditions under which these women live? Kemble's account of her days on Butler Island portrays her husband and any man who believed as he did as an indifferent tyrant. Upon their return to Philadelphia in May 1839, Fanny gave Pierce an ultimatum. If the family livelihood continued to be drawn from slave labor, she no longer wanted to stay with him. Butler dismissed this as the height of hypocrisy. The act of marrying a slave owner made her also a slave owner, and her support, as well as mine, was derived from slave labor. Kemble denied her husband the marriage bed. She might have feared the prospect of an additional child, but she also recognized sexuality as her only means of control. At the height of their misery, she quoted to Butler his own words. "What need of intellectual converse? Have you not an affectionate husband and 2 sweet babies?" Her reply, "You might as well say to a man who told you he had no arms, 'Oh, but you have 2 legs.'" Alarmed at his wife's rebelliousness, Pierce wrote to her friends, Charles and Elizabeth Sedgwick in Lenox, Massachusetts, claiming to be afraid for Fanny's mental health. He repeated her threat to take Sarah to London and to leave him with 1-year-old Fan. Butler begged the Sedgwicks to intercede on his behalf, concealing that he was spending more nights in Philadelphia than he did in their suburban home in Branchtown. Although Fanny likely suspected Pierce of infidelity, her strict code of privacy prevented her from sharing these fears with the Sedgwicks, who lent Butler their sympathy. Elizabeth Sedgwick wrote Fanny a strongly worded letter. "Your mind is positively and greatly diseased. You have no right to deprive your husband of his children. You inherit undoubtedly from your mother morbid tendencies, which poison and spoil all." At the same time, the Sedgwicks counseled Butler to be soothing and compassionate toward Fanny. The Sedgwicks also invited Fanny and the children to Lenox for a prolonged visit. Butler's letters during this period exude a melancholy. "If I cannot have happiness in my own home, it is nowhere for me. I may not be happy with you," he wrote to Fanny. "But oh, most true it is, I cannot be happy without you." But even the sweetest letter could not overcome the disharmony that reigned in October 1839 when the couple were reunited at Butler Place. Against Pierce's express wishes, Fanny continued to rail against slavery and allowed her journal to circulate among abolitionists. He retaliated by giving her 1 day's notice that he planned to winter in Georgia and that she should stay behind. Although ill health delayed his parting, he felt no regret at going off and leaving Kemble alone. During their prolonged separation, Butler fell seriously ill yet again. News of his condition filled Kemble with despair and regret. She wrote to her husband on his sickbed, "God bless you, my darling, dearest Pierce, when you think of me, if you think of me. Forgive me, my dearest Pierce, if I have so bitterly cursed your existence. I cannot write more. I'm blinded with crying." Butler recovered enough to travel home that spring. So grateful was she for his safe return that Kemble promised never again to mention slavery.
You've been listening to Catherine Clinton, the author of Fanny Kemble's Civil War, the story of America's most unlikely abolitionist.